Accession number 28496, Reel 4.
To Whitley Reel 4. Was it a constant thing, the bombing during Malta, or were there lulls in different periods?
No, there were lulls. In actual fact, when Germany invaded Russia, it all went quiet. It really started about the same time as Illustrious was bombed. That's when the Germans appeared. And they hammered Malta, mainly after the ship to begin with, and then they sort of disappeared after this thing in Russia. And then in Easter 42, about that time, I don't know whether they were trying to soften Malta up for an invasion or not, but it really... there was a really bad spell there for quite a long time. And the sort of thing that would happen is that you get some fighters in, flown in with enormous trouble, you know, hoisting them on aircraft carriers and flying them off. And I suppose the Germans could count the things arriving just as you could count their aircraft taking off. And they were often destroyed before they could be put to use. And the Hurricane was really no match for a 109. And then they had this blitz effort in which they got everything lined up, all three services, on an airfield, you know, with the army sort of helping move things. And as these aircraft arrived, they were descended upon. The overload tanks were whipped off, they were fueled, armed, the pilot was dragged out, and a resident pilot was stuck in the cockpit, and they were airborne in 15-20 minutes, and they got enough then to make a difference with the Germans, and it got a bit better after that. But yes, there were high points and lower points, and then the invasion was sort of called off and it went a bit quiet again. There was a bit of spurt in September, October, just when we were leaving, but nothing like the Easter 1942 one, because somebody wrote a poem called Kesselring's Easter Prayer, and I wish I could get a copy of it. Because I see the boys on Saffy Strip, we will make the bastards nip. And Saffy Strip was a strip between our airfield and Lucca, which was just bulldozed through the fields, and it had a border of bomb craters, and we said you needed a VC to go on there and a VC and a bar to work on there. And when we lost an aeroplane there, when we were telling about moving these aircraft, the old flight sergeant kept saying, "Where's Blenheim number so and so?" And said, "Oh, you don't know." Because they were all down on this Saffy Strip, and a lot of the people could taxi the aeroplanes themselves. You know, we'd ride down there with an Air Force guy. And one day we were in this open truck. We used to travel around in open trucks with a Maltese driver if there was transport. And we got too far down Saffy Strip, and we'd bashed on the cab, and he hadn't stopped, and we found this Blenheim, which we'd stashed behind one of the few trees in Malta and hadn't noticed it, you know. So that's the biggest thing we ever lost, so we found that all right.
With aircraft losses, would it be a case of, as when you were working with the Swordfish, would gradually all the Swordfishes just become unserviceable or be lost on operations and you wouldn't have any left?
Yes, yes, they'd be flying a few more. And, of course, they were repairing aircraft down in Califrana, but which was an Air Force peacetime seaplane station with big hangars and slipways. And the road between there and Halfar was big enough to tow the aircraft up. And that's... I was down in California when that was clobbered. And when we came out of the shelter, somebody came down the shelter and said, if you don't want to get roasted, you better come out. The shelter was under a store, and the beams in the roof for the rest of they were dull red. And we got out of this place, and we were clambering over the Spitfires and the wreckage. Quite a lot of damage done. And it's done occasionally extra aircraft were flown in, and then some albacores came in, 8-8 squadron, and so we had an albacore and a swordfish squadron, and then as things ran down, they were combined.
So it was almost always a constant...
Oh, yes.
Replacements and
that's
then building
right.
up and then it running down
yeah,
again. And
that's right.
Again,
and the air crew were relieved after about 6 months. And they relieved us after, well, it was nearly a couple of years when I got away. It's 1 3/4 years.
Were you aware of the postal convoy coming in at all?
Oh, gosh, yes. Oh, yes. Great fuss in Malta. I mean, I don't think we knew it was coming. We knew it was necessary because I think the place was getting a few days off having to give up.
Was the shortages of things like aviation fuel and that sort of thing?
Oh, yes, yeah.
At that point?
Yeah. The aviation fuel came in 4-gallon drums. And, you know, you had to fuel the aircraft carting these drums around.
How would you fuel the aircraft at that stage?
Well, you take the bung off the 40-gallon drum and pour it into a funnel in the filler cap on the top of the tank.
Was there a shortage of... well, you mentioned how the torpedoes came in.
Yeah.
Was there a shortage of torpedoes and bombs? And
oh, yes,
and
yeah.
Machine guns.
Yes, oh, yes. Yeah.
How did you come to leave Malta?
Well, eventually they said, they got a group of us, they said, right, it's your turn to go home. And we were sent down to HMS St. Angelo to await passage. And we were taken aboard the submarine and told where we were going to sleep. We were not amused. Because the middle of the Mediterranean was full of mines, amongst other things. And, you know, everybody's horrified if they're at all close to her. Anyway, we didn't want to know. But we thought, well, at least we'll get home. And then they got a group of us together and said, right, there's a liberator up at Halfar, at Lucca. Go up there. Here's a bully beef sandwich. If you don't go, don't eat it because it's your breakfast. So off we went to Lucca. And there was this liberator, and it was a fairly quiet day in Malta. We'd had to nip into a slit trench a couple of times. And the flight lieutenant who was flying this aeroplane said... I'm only supposed to take it to Jim, he said. Well, he asked what it was like in Malta, and we said, oh, it's very, very quiet today. And he said, oh, my God. He said, I'm only supposed to take it to Jim. I'll take you all the way home. And this liberator's Bombay was boarded up. It had 1.5 machine gun in the tail, and 33 of us piled into the Bombay of this thing on our kit bags. I had been weighed in a naval uniform with a Burberry Mac, and a full-size respirator, and I weighed 10 stones. I weigh 10 and a half now with nothing on. And we all clambered into this Bombay, and it took off. And there was a crew compartment just behind the Bombay, and I managed to get in that for the 6 or 7 hours to jib, and look through the window and see this gorgeous green grass, which, of course, there wasn't any left in Malta. And we landed at jib, and trooped into the galley and were given baked beans on fried bread, and the people there couldn't understand why we had two lots, you know, such a basic breakfast. And then we got in the liberator again and flew off in a great swoop round the Bay of Biscay, because there were loads of 88s loafing about there. And we landed at Lynham, where the group captain was standing there with his dog and his stick, and about 20 people clambered out of this aeroplane, his jaw was dropping him, and 33 had clambered out, and the crew was still in.
So what happened to you when you'd returned to the UK? What was the...
Well, we got as far as Southampton, and there were no more trains, so we slept in a train all night at Southampton, went to Leon Solent, was sent home on leave, had a month's leave, came back, and then went to Royal Air Force Hednesford to do a 6-month course to become an air artificer.
What did that course entail that you didn't know before?
Well, very little, actually, because it was training an airframe chap with engines and an engine chap with airframes. And as we'd done it at Halton, in fact, some of us got such high marks that they took us away and wanted to know what had happened. Of course, when they found out, they realised that we'd done it all before. I also had my 21st birthday there and went out to a pub in Cannock and got good and tight, and on the way back to the railway station was introduced to a waff who later became my wife. Then I, when the course was over, I was sent down to HMS Dipper in Somerset, which was a fighter training school, and I was in the engine repair shop there. And I went away for a weekend to see my girlfriend, and when I got back, they wanted people to check trait tests in Newcastle under Lyme in an establishment that had been moved there off the south coast. So I went, everybody had made their excuses while I was away, so I got shunted off there to do this job. And then when I finished it, they asked if I'd like to be an instructor there. So I went to Newcastle under Lyme instructing aircraft engines and propellers, carburetors and things, until a bit later in the war, when I was sent off to in about June 1945, I was sent off to stand by a fleet repair ship called HMS Home Sound. Now, they were building up this Pacific Fleet train to cope with the distances in the Pacific, and they had a carrier, Perseus Pioneer, I think, which got the damaged aircraft, and then the bits were parked out. One ship did engine repairs, it had a test bench on the after end. We did propellers, hydraulics, wing repairs, and we commissioned the ship on VJ Day. So, first of all, we couldn't splice the main brace because the rum store was welded up to stop the dockies pinching the rum. And, of course, the war had come to an end, but Home Sound went out to the Pacific to try all the machinery in the hot weather and so on, you know.
How did it all work? Did it work okay in the hot
weather? Well, some of the cooling water in the Red Sea, the cooling water was coming into the ship at the temperature it should have gone out at. I mean, the ship was an 11,000 ton merchant ship, so she was okay. And of course, we found that you couldn't balance propellers because you can't stop all the fans in the magazines and so on. But it was quite interesting in a way. And I mean, really, with the exception of a couple of fly bomb raids, my war ended in October 1942.
That period when you'd done the instructing.
Yeah.
You said you were instructing in trade testing.
Yeah.
What would really that involve at the time?
Well, the trade testing was the chaps went into this establishment to be trained as artificer apprentices, and they were doing the basic fitting and turning that we had done at Halton, although add the turning, because you don't do much turning on aircraft work. And when you invigilate a trade test, you give these chaps the piece of metal to do the job with a stamp on it, so that if they cock it up and steal it and find a piece somewhere else, they can't have a second try. And then when it's finished, you mark it, you know, you measure it up and check the parallels and all this sort of thing with micrometers and verniers and things, and then they get their exam mark. And they then went on to into an old bus station in Clayton in Newcastle under Lyme, where we had aircraft and engines and workshops and things and classrooms. And I rather liked instructing. And despite the fact that I was only 21 and they were 17, 18, which made it a bit more difficult, it worked out all right because they knew he'd just come back from the war, you see.
Were you promoted at that time?
Yeah, well, yes. When you finished the course at Hednesford, I became a petty officer, an air artificer fourth class. And that was backdated considerably because I'd been in Malta for a long time with the previous race, except I didn't get any back pay. And then an air artificer third class was a chief petty officer. And so I got that very, very quickly. And then I became a chief air artificer in 46. And I realised that I couldn't get any further. So I took the profession examination for a commission. You had to be recommended, you had to have a higher education test, and they were called warrant officers in those days, which of course caused a bit of confusion with other services. And so I was commissioned in 48.
What had you signed on for originally when you, you know, with
12 years.
So had you at that point thought, this is going to be the life for me?
Well, yes, I didn't seem to want to do anything else. And I suppose that really, that you imagined that you were going to sign on for the other 10, which you had to do 22 then to get a pension. And in actual fact, I must have... What actually happened after the war, I think they realised they got rid of people too quickly, and they wanted some people to sign on, and they gave you £33 and a dim-up suit. And I did that in 1946. Yeah, that's right, something like that. So I was really on for 3 years on top of my 12. But, I mean, we're obviously looking at a commission.
And once commissioned, where did you go to then?
We did a knife, fork and spoon course in Portsmouth Barracks, and an officer's divisional course. And then I went to Northern Ireland, to Eglinton, and I had station flight to begin with, which was a communications aircraft and some air sea rescue aircraft. And then I had a maintenance unit on Sea Fires, and later Fireflies. And then I did a training job down in HMS Fisgard in Cornwall.
Prior to that, though, what was your opinion of the Sea Fire?
Well, if you ask me what my favourite aircraft, the Swordfish because of what it did, the Spitfire other than the Sea Fire because it's one of the most beautiful aircraft, and finally the Buccaneer. They've just covered it up. I was involved with the Buccaneer Mark II coming into service at Boscombe, and so I've got a lot of time for the Buccaneer. The Sea Fire was not a good naval aircraft because of its narrow undercarriage, but it's a great aeroplane.
Was this the time that you met Peter Twiss?
Yes.
Can you describe what he was doing?
What actually happened was the Gannet... The Navy wanted an anti-submarine aircraft, and Fairies had made the Gannet, and Blackburns had made the YB something or other as a competitor. And they both did the playoff, or the final assessment of them, at Eglinton in the dispersal where my maintenance unit was. So there was Peter Twiss and Jack Hillard from Fairies, and a chap who's no longer with us from Blackburns. And the awful thing was that they had they made the choice before they finished all the checks. So I had a happy group of blokes in one office and a miserable shower in another. And Peter Twiss, I got to know him as the pilot, and also when they'd finished their stint, they wanted some meat, and we went over into Aera to buy some meat. And I got to run through that, and also we were then once flew down to a Royal Aeronautical Society garden party at White Waltham, and he phoned up and said, "Get me a couple of hams."
Can you explain to me what they were doing with the Gannet trials? What type of thing they were doing with the aircraft?
Well, they were they'd be assessing their handling. I can't remember if there must have been, some of our pilots must have been flying them as well. And unfortunately, the Blackburn aircraft, they hadn't got the gas turbine they wanted for it, wasn't ready. And it had a Griffin with a contra-rotating propeller. And really, although they were sharing the dispersal I was in, I think I had quite a lot to do with my ordinary job, and I'm not quite sure what they did from the flying point of view.
What did you think of the Gannet?
Well, it's the most unusual aircraft, but it lasted a long time, and it was big enough to eventually put the crew inside with the ASV and the radar and so on, and it was fine, and we didn't have a mat in the Falklands.
What was your pattern of career after that then? What was the...
Oh gosh! When I finished Fizzguard, I stood by Bulwark, was being fitted out in Belfast. I was her deputy air engineer officer, so I was the AC rescue aircraft, the transport, and she was put back 6 months when I joined her. They were putting on a small angle deck, so I became the ship's welfare officer and all sorts of things. And I was chosen to sit aboard for promotion onto the general list as opposed to the special duties list, which is what we were eventually called. And I was flown off Bulwark by Hoey Carmichael in an Avenger down to Leon Solent. I sat the board there and managed to pass it. I then did a junior officer's war course at Manidon, at Greenwich, and a short technical course at Manidon in Plymouth. And then I went to see an HMS Ceylon to get a Marine Engineer Officer's ticket. At this time, if you were an air engineer or an ordnance engineer or a marine engineer, you had to have a Marine Engineering Officer's ticket. And I got one, and I thought, well, that's that. And I left the ship as soon as I got it. I really liked to have stayed a bit longer to learn a bit more about it, although I didn't really like marine engineering. But she became a flagship and they wanted the accommodation, so I was sent home on a troop ship. And then I had a job at Donibristol, where, first of all, I was the aircraft custodian, which meant I had to sign them for all the engines and aircraft, because none of the civil service would... Well, Donibristol, first of all, I was dealing with the movement of the aircraft and engines, and then I became the test flight engineer, and then they decided to close the establishment, and I was on a rundown committee there with a civilian officer and, very wisely, a shop steward. And we had to find work for 1,400 people. We also had to keep the place running. We had all the test beds there that they were going to put somewhere else. And the test beds were run by dilutees. And if you fired anybody out of these 1,400 people, you then had to fire the women, then the dilutees. And you'd lose control of the situation. So a planning officer had worked it all out, and it's quite a complex operation. I think we had people in from the aircraft firms, we had people in from the Bureau, as they call it in Scotland, the Labour Exchange, and I think we succeeded in all but about 40 out of these 1,400 people. And then, when I left Donibristol, to my surprise, I became the engineer officer of Frigate.
What was that like? What was the kind of role an engineering officer would take aboard a frigate?
Well, you're in charge of A, the engines, B, the hull, C, the stores, and you have to run all this lot. And we were the frigates in the 2nd Frigate Squadron at Portland, I wouldn't have missed the small ship time, but I hadn't really had enough marine experience, so it was quite a difficult job.
Who did you have under you?
Well, we had the chief ERA and the ERAs and so on. It's a long story, and unfortunately, the chief RA, I knew him from Ceylon, but his wife was ill, and a lot of various things went wrong, and the Type 14 frigates were not the worst. Oh, yes, we had a fair number of difficulties. They were all sorted out eventually, and I left her in 61, I think, and had a stint in the Admiralty.
What did that entail?
Well, I was in what was called the repair section of the aircraft department, and I'd mentioned earlier Donibristol, which was a repair yard. We had another one at Fleetlands in Hampshire. We had one in Belfast, and we had store depots and workshops in Perth and Llangennig in Wales. And my job was feeding the repair work of aircraft spares into these establishments. And one had to liaise with the stores people who were getting them. And of course you had to work with the aircraft firms who were making spares and so on. And you've always got modifications coming along needing different tooling and different spares and so on. And it's quite a complex problem.
Did you enjoy the job working in that kind of... Because it's more of an administration role, isn't it?
Well, yes, but it involved visiting all these places. And it was quite interesting because it was very, very complex. And you often had to sort out problems which had occurred. You know, you'd find, for example, that a particular component, they were having difficulty in servicing it in an aircraft factory. And one example, I went down and said, why are you having this problem? And they said, well, we moved this unit and we lost the jigs. And I said, well, we paid you for these jigs, didn't we? And they said, yes. I said, you'd better make some more, hadn't you? That sort of thing, you know. So it was quite interesting. And of course, in a way, it was quite pleasant to be living near to London. I mean, I wouldn't want to do it again.
Where were you living at the
in,
time?
In Welling, in Kent. So it was a train ride into Charing Cross and then to walk down the road to the Admiralty.
Would you wear civilian clothes for that?
Oh, yes. Except that you would wear your uniform if you went to visit one of the establishments.
Relations with these establishments, because that sounds, the example you gave seems quite an interesting example,
yeah,
of how they would view a certain matter.
Yeah.
How were relations generally between the Admiralty and the suppliers?
Well, all the service people, as a rule, distrust civil servants. They also distrust trades unions. But if you're going to work with these people, you've got to get on with them. And it's no good going in there and flashing your rank and a sword at them. It's not going to get anywhere at all. And I've just had copies of all my confidential reports, and they all say that I was got on with them very well.
Did you have to exercise an awful lot of tact?
Oh, yes. Yes, you can't go in and say, this is no damn good. You do have to be tactful.
But does there come a point, as in the example that you gave, where you have to sort of lay down?
Oh, yes.
As well?
Oh,
so
yes.
Is it a balancing act?
Oh, yes, but you can do it in a nice way.
Was it a satisfying role, that? Did you find it interesting and fulfilling? Or?
Oh, yes. Because it was so very, very complex. I mean, you never knew, for example, what might happen next. When the Buccaneer first went to sea, some magnesium alloy panels on them didn't last very long in the sea air. And we wanted a lot more very, very quickly, and it was quicker to get them made in one of our workshops than to get them from the manufacturer. So you get that sort of problem to deal with.